We are here to discuss some well, time travel. It's all about time, isn't it? Time. Time. As the Earth Doctor tried to grasp reality. There's a lot of time travel these days. When I was a kid, time travel was just kind of the domain of kids' TV, maybe kids' movies occasionally. But these days, time travel's everywhere in terms of.
We know what you're talking about.
Do we?
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
Everyone listening to this knows what you're talking
What am
about.
I talking about?
Clearly, you're talking about Fonz and the Happy Days Gang.
Was the time travel in that?
Do you not remember Fonz and the Happy Days
I
Gang?
remember it existing. I don't think I ever watched it. I think it was one of
It was.
those churned out Hanna-Barbera things, wasn't it? Like
Absolutely.
the basketball fellas. And when it
With.
became apparent that there were so many Hanna-Barbera cartoons that they were churning out, I kind of lost interest in watching them.
That was a mistake because you missed out on
Okay.
Fonz and the Happy Days Gang.
Where did they travel to, James? Pray tell
Well,
me.
basically, the premise was Fonz and the Happy Days Gang are hanging out at their Happy Days joint with, obviously, with their cute, quirky Hanna-Barbera dog, Mr. Cool, who is a small dog which emulates and mimics the Fonz
We need a side
throughout.
camera. We need a Harry Hill side camera right now.
As a sidebar, Mr. Cool and the Fonz also appeared in it wasn't Joey and Charlie. What was the other spin-off they did?
Laverne and
From
Shirley.
Happy Days. Yes, they did an they did Hanna-Barbera did an animated one of them as well. Second season, the Fonz appeared in that with Mr. Cool. But I digress from the digress. So Fonz and the Happy Days Gang starts off with the Fonz and the Happy Days Gang and Mr. Cool hanging out outside the diner, and then a time machine crashes next to them.
Right.
And the time
Of
machine's
course.
occupant, this woman, they go in because this is all obviously set up in the credits, in the intro credits, rather than actually as a story. Go in, and then it malfunctions and it takes them off through time and space. And they don't know where they're going to land, and they don't know who the Fonz and the Happy Days gang are going to encounter, Romans, Victorians, who knows? Dinosaurs, I'm sure, probably, because Hanna-Barbera, there was those dinosaur episode. And that was the premise. And it was them in a time machine going through various points of time, and the Fonz basically Fonzing
Okay.
everyone throughout history.
Was Sidney Newman at Hanna-Barbera at this point, or?
No, but what was interesting was that, as we know, Hanna-Barbera's animation was kind of set around, I don't want to call it cheap, but it was economical in
Yeah.
its approach.
Production line.
So scaling was an issue. So the inside of this time machine was invariably so much bigger than the outside, which I don't think was an TARDIS attempt, just simply that they needed a bigger background scene for the inside for them to do the conversations inside than they
Okay.
needed for the thing to be outside.
Wow.
It was one of those things. I remember my dad used to get really furious with the Godzilla cartoon because
I remember
their boat kept changing size, and so did Godzilla, depending on the shot, and that would drive him up the wall. So
that.
it was it, scaling was a massive issue in cartoons, and
Yeah.
he actually made that a massive issue for me, which is why I'm now terribly upset, having realized as an adult the Millennium Falcon exterior is three quarters of what it would need to be for the interior to fit in it. And
Oh, I'm over that now.
but anyway, so clearly Fonz and the Happy Days Gang is what you were thinking about in the 80s, where time travel was everywhere. And I can't think of actually a better example of where time travel just infects something which has no need and there is no desire to see it go through time.
Do you know the thing that I was actually thinking of was, I mean, there was a, I was vaguely, I had Quantum Leap vaguely in my head, but the thing that I was
Yep.
specifically thinking of was Star Trek 4.
Oh, yeah, The Voyage Home.
Yeah.
Classic film, even better book, but carry on.
Who wrote the book?
Vonda McIntyre.
Okay.
She also wrote the third one as well. She's a very good writer, author. I remember it was probably the summer of what it would have been, 86, 87. And probably 87, because I think I got it
I
after
think
the
it was
film came
87.
out. And I remember getting it from a local news agent shop, which had books, that sort of thing they had at the time, and sitting in the garden and reading it and just really enjoying the book.
Yeah.
It's one of the few books I read over and over again. And it captured the film very well. The third
I
book's even better because the third of the Star Trek 3, the book, about a third, almost a half of it is just brand new material before it gets
All
to
right.
it. So it's a really good book. But anyway, yes, it
Well,
is a
no,
time
it's
travel
interesting that because
extravaganza.
I found because I read the novelization of Aliens, and there's a load of stuff at the beginning of that that isn't in the main cut, and I think some of it also isn't in the director's cut. So that was a very different experience reading the Aliens film.
Labyrinth as well is a really interesting one, because I
Right.
think these are cases where obviously the film they're given, the author's given a script to work from, and then the script changes, and
Yeah,
through test
and then
screening
there's
stuff
cuts in the
changes.
edits, and then
Exactly. So you get things like Labyrinth, which was really interesting because at the end of the Labyrinth book, the endings you can feel is the ending that the film was intentionally going to take, where she kind of says to them before she goes and meets Jareth, she says to her friends, the Hoggle and the like, "Am I ever going to see you again?" And they kind of go, "No." Because the basis is it's a coming of age thing, and she's moving into adulthood, and she will leave them behind. And then you have this extra scene in the film where she's in a room and sort of goes, "I miss them." And they go, "Well, we can be around sometimes in your life." And then there's a great big party, and they're all there. And you go, "Yeah, there we see where there's been a shift." So novelizations, especially in the 80s, were really interesting for that reason, because as you say, you'd get a sense of where films were probably intended to go but didn't go, and you get these little extra bits.
Well, that's a different podcast. So time travel. I mean, we've talked about doing a show just about time travel for quite some time now, because there is a lot of time travel around now. Obviously there's Doctor Who, but there's actually what a lot of Moffat's era of Doctor Who borrowed from, which was Time Traveler's Wife. Which obviously was did have a time travel thing, and later, I mean, that was, I think that was a just a novel. I think the movie came out a little bit later, maybe around the same time as Doctor Who. It's very difficult to sort of like watch something without actual time travel in it, or without, we're talking about this, was it me and someone else were talking about this, about the heavy reliance on non-linear structures in dramas over the past sort of decade.
Well, I absolutely just watched a couple of days ago, watched the first episode of season 4 of The Bear, and The Bear, which is again nothing to do with time travel, just about a restaurant. The amount of, as you say, shifts and non-linear movement within the story is very common as a way of. I mean, Ron Moore used to talk about it a lot when he was doing Battlestar Galactica, and he would say, if an episode was kind of boring in the edit, that's when you try and break the chronology of it, and you'd sort of open in the cold teaser with maybe near the ending of the story, and then let the rest of the story catch up to that point, just to make the story more engaging. So there's ways that that non-linear approach is used to heighten interests in stories which perhaps aren't quite as interesting as they wanted them to be.
It's something that came up a lot in American drama, cult drama shows as well. In fact, I mean, this ties in with Julian McMahon died a few days ago, which came as a massive surprise. And we were watching an episode of Charmed. In fact, the last episode of Charmed that we watched was about a month ago, and it was an episode from maybe the second or third series where there's time travel involved. Coincidentally, they got back to, I think, witch trial era. And that, I mean, that happened in that show quite a lot. And that, a lot of those 80s and 90s shows, I didn't, I'm not in the early 2000s. I didn't watch B Buffy a lot, but was there time travel in that?
Not massively. I think there might be some dream episodes which sort of had time related to it, but I think it was actually one of the few which didn't massively do it. There was probably ones my brain's going where time repeated and things like that, but again, time travel is a big is a big bracket for lots of different ways of deploying it as part of a story, from that sort of approach, that sort of bodily approach, to actually structured like Doctor Who, or as you say, Quantum Leap. It's I've yesterday I watched, because it came onto Prime, The Flash, the recent DC movie, which has the Flash changing time, which again is an interesting thing, because it's almost responding to, and I'm not saying out of copying, but just simply because both franchises deal a lot with time travel. Marvel's time travel, and there's a bit in the DC one where they sort of say, you could, Michael Keaton's Batman sort of explains time travelers, you could see it as branches off a timeline, obviously referring to the Marvel one. You have a straight and yet things branch out, and then he goes, "It's not like that at all, it's rubbish. This is what it's like. This is what it's like for our brand, franchise. It's like spaghetti." So there's always that sort of thing with time travelers, is that even in its essence, and it's a time travel show, the rules of that time travel are often inconsistent with other shows, but also with themselves quite
With
frequently,
themselves,
as Doctor Who is. I've always liked ones where there is a consistency. I like there to be a certain structure in my shows, or a deliberate attempt to devoid themselves of structure. While I hate the term timey-wimey, I like the notion of sort of saying time travel is just so complicated the human brain can't understand it, so don't try and work it out, just go with it. I think that's a nice narrative ploy to get you to put your guard down and just go, yeah, what's going to happen is what happens.
Just with Doctor Who, 30 years ago, the BBC Books editor,
Oh,
writers
yes, I know
guy
where you're going with
nonce,
this, yeah.
they posited that Gallifrey's in the future and only travel back in time is possible for Time Lords, and then return into the future point of Gallifrey. So traveling backwards and forwards within the past of Gallifrey, as it were, and that was kept pretty consistent within the Virgin books, I think.
Well, they kept
I
it.
meant the Virgin notes, not the BBC notes.
Yeah, because it was the Web of Time was came from them, wasn't it? They talked a lot about the Web of Time, and I think it was those books which came up with the idea of like Nexus points, which you couldn't really change. I'm pretty sure that was the
Yeah, I
Virgin
think
books which
so.
started it. And yeah, like you said, Gallifrey existed in its own kind of time stream where you couldn't leap ahead. You could
You
only.
couldn't go into Gallifrey's future, but you could go into Gallifrey's past, although you weren't allowed to because it's prohibited.
And it was, yeah, I think it was locked or something. But yes, so much of that was. It's incredible how much that those books impacted on Doctor Who. And I find it, I know, and I appreciate that so many people have an issue with Timeless Child, and I get that. As if it's like a Chibnall construct. You know, Chibnall, here he is coming and creating this ridiculous notion. It's like that's he's just taken it out of those books. That's what the book said. Now, whether the TV show should have said it is a different thing, but that's not a Chibnall thing. That's a Virgin Media thing. This idea that there was multiple incarnations of the Doctor prior, and obviously they based that riffed that off the brain of Morbius. So it's funny that that is a period which has had such an impact on the ongoing understanding of the temporal mechanics of Doctor Who, largely still comes from those books.
But it is a very funny thing as well, isn't it? Because it's attempting to resolve apparent inconsistencies with
But
Brain of
isn't.
Morbius and with the dialogue in Remembrance of the Daleks and various other bits and bobs here and there. It doesn't
But
really
isn't that.
necessarily need to for a mass audience, does it?
Is it, isn't that just the nature of adaptation? Adaptation is someone who is inspired by something, recreating it in a way which probably makes more sense to them, where they can actually tease out what didn't make sense to them or what they might find more interesting. That's how it works. That's how James Bond evolves. That's how Star Wars evolves. It's how Sherlock evolves. It's people overanalyzing something and then replicating it without the repetition, which I think Linda Hutcheon calls it repetition, replication without repetition. And again, I thought it was interesting because at the same, it was the same feeling I had when I was reading the Virgin Media books. Was like, oh, hang on, they're trying to actually revitalize Doctor Who into doing into so we see it as something different, which is what Cartmell was trying to do. This notion that who is the Doctor, trying to get people to rethink and get away from this almost pedestrian notion as we'd got by that point of what the Doctor was, and get people to rethink the character. And I get the impression that's what Timeless Child was trying to do, was just to get us to rethink and reimagine again and revitalize our conversations about who this person is, who we still don't really know because they come from a universe beyond that. So they've kept, and we don't know what happened within that murky timeline. So they've tried to keep the mystery while trying to build it, like Lung Barrow did as well. Lung Barrow was famous for that. And I know we kind of go, well, I suppose we're still on time travel to a degree. But you're right, there is always a danger of taking, in terms of a product, something which has got an easy, simple sell to get mass appeal, so it's not confusing to everyone, and then complicating it to a point where it no longer carries that easy digestion. And I think Davis has been quite clever with that, insofar as he's acknowledged that existence of that timeline, of that Timeless Child, but has been very wary not to bend into it, because I think, yes, you're right. As soon as you do, and you start overcomplicating it, audiences are going to start feeling left out, disconnected. And this goes back to time travel, isn't it? It's one of the issues with time travel in TV shows is how do you make it interesting without annoying audiences who get confused by it, or dumbing it down so it's not interesting. So where how do you balance that out? And I think we've seen time travel getting more sophisticated in its use. In the last 20 years, certainly.
I think there's a few shows that I've seen where, and I think Charmed is one of them. Another one is certainly in its, and another one is the thing that Robert Carlyle was in, the Disney thing, Once Upon a Time,
Okay.
where later series they tend to rely more and more on time travel in order to resolve plot points, or just because there's maybe a shortage of. Maybe those episodes were popular, so they want to do more episodes of that type. Or also maybe because there's a narrower set of priorities for the characters, and time travel maybe opens up some older motivations or whatever. So I think that is, and I mean that happens quite a lot in TV shows. Certainly the ones that Kerry and I have watched. But there's other types of shows as well about time travel. There's Life on Mars, which isn't about time travel, but it exists because of a perceived instance of time travel.
Yeah, absolutely. And the audience's perception as well, that this is so narrative within the show, he thinks it's time travel. Outside the show, you are to believe it's time travel, even though it's kind of not. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was one of, again, another or one of the rare examples that British outside of Doctor Who where time travel worked. Because famously, there was the Crime Traveller in the 90s, which was absolutely panned. I didn't think it
That
was
was
as bad
Michael
as
French,
people.
wasn't it?
It was Michael French. It was a vehicle for
And
him. And it.
was it the girl at Red Dwarf as well?
Yes, it was, wasn't it? Chloe
Yeah.
Annette.
Yes, that was her, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think it was as bad as people thought it was. And maybe that was because, again, there was nothing for thirsty sci-fi fans to really watch anymore. I was never quite sure whether it was a reaction to there being no Doctor Who and suddenly this thing comes along which kind of replaces Doctor Who and people being like, this is weak derivative stuff. But
This is weak
it
derivative
felt
stuff. Where is Doctor Who? It's
exactly.
pretty the gist you got from SFX magazine, certainly.
And funnily enough, there was a lot of shows, there were shows in the 90s where where British television would try and do sci-fi, and it'd always feel like the Crime Traveller is as if it was either a dirty fetish and they didn't really want to touch it too closely. And so it was kind of hands off and a bit silly. I'm also thinking of Randall Hopkirk and Deceased with Vic
Yeah,
Reeves and Bob
with Vic and
Mortimer,
Bob.
which again, apart from its final episode, felt like it just didn't really believe in itself, that it was a sort of almost a sort of semi satire of a show that had happened in the 60s that people are half remembering it. I never felt it felt particularly.
All
I
right.
know you
Which
quite
is
like it.
the final episode?
The one with Gareth Thomas, I think, was the last one they aired. With it, where he's, I think he's a publican. Blake
Oh,
Seven.
right at the end. Right. Oh, is that the episode, is that the end of the second series?
Might be. Well, it might
Yeah.
be the end of the first series. I,
Well,
it's been a couple of decades,
God,
but
I've got them on DVD, but I haven't watched them for a while.
but
But
that
yeah.
one I thought was particularly strong. But by and large, I felt while the there was an interest in it, just. It wasn't until Life on Mars that I feel that there was a British show outside Doctor Who, which was like, let's take this and
Yeah.
absolutely run with it with confidence. Let's really make this, let's get us to buy into this. Because Time Traveller, as you sort of suggested, outside of Doctor Who, especially for the British, but I think also to a degree for America as well, was a sort of slightly silly topic. When it's deployed in Star Trek, as you said, The Voyage Home, it's a pure comedy piece, really, comedy adventure. There's no sense of Bill and Ted, similar comedy adventure. Quantum Leap sits a little outside of that. But then, to some degree, Quantum Leap, while it is very much a time travel show, its core is a melodrama. It's about the drama of that, it's almost an anthology of different stories with the same character popped in to resolve them. That's the only one I can think of, which, and even then, that is very light. It's very light. Melodrama, TV. The sci-fi is very limited in it. It's not really a sci-fi. It's time travel in drama rather than time travel in sci-fi. But it worked.
I've got a list here of British time travel TV series. So I've got Life on Mars, obviously, and Ashes to Ashes. Good Night, Sweetheart, of course.
Absolutely weird, gross for show, but popular.
Yes.
Let's
It's
celebrate a
yeah.
guy
If
who
you
is
sell, if you think about it too hard, it's like, this guy is horrible. Why are we watching this?
Yes. Why are we, why should we care about what happens to him? He's having his cake and eating it and never gets caught and loves it and then has a decent ending, as I recall. I can't remember it exactly, but yeah.
Although the revival episode I thought was quite good.
Oh, I didn't see it.
Yeah, because he'd been stuck in the 1940s or whatever, and it was the 1960s, and he accidentally gets home, and it's the 2010s. And so
Oh,
he's
that's interesting.
got a grown up son. And so yeah, and I think he's got
It
a
makes me
child at both
think.
ends.
It makes me think of there's some really nice mock-ups on Pinterest I saw of newspapers set in 1963 and 1964, which is like, where has this child gone? Where has who are these two teachers who have taken this child?
Right.
Well, who was this mysterious doctor? These local Shoreditch papers,
Yeah.
newspaper covers of like, again, the repercussions of time travel where people
Yeah.
just disappear. What happens in the meantime?
Yeah.
And sometimes you get that. I mean, Doctor Who with its Aliens of London was quite unusual for exploring that. You know,
Yes, it
Rose
was,
is
yeah.
taken away, and what happens as a result of that?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a shame they don't really go back to that, really. It's I mean, there's a lot with the first couple of series of the Doctor Who revival series that do things that haven't really been done again and were really interesting, like that, and like the
I'd like
relationship
to,
between Rose and her mum being, you know,
yeah.
traveling around in the phone calls, etc.
But I watched season 10, isn't it? The last Capaldi one. Season, no, not season 10, season
No.
13. Oh, who cares? Season 10, no, I think it's season 10, series 10. And I was thinking that at the end, you know, Bill gets whisked away, made into a Cyberman, and then turns into a water thing and disappears. And it's like she's got a mum. She has a house. There's that university where suddenly the doctor's no longer there. There's no, that's just totally forgotten. And those are sort of things which I know, again, from mainstream audience, doesn't matter, especially with Doctor Who, where the show does literally can just moves forward. But it did feel almost like, yeah, we're in an age where I think we should be acknowledging these things.
Yes. No, yeah, I agree. All the British TV shows, I haven't heard of all this. There's Crime Travelers, you mentioned. There's Catweasel. There's Sapphire and Steel.
Yeah.
Time Wasters, well, I think it's a relatively recent one. I got the impression that was about some sort of band or something. There's Time Traveler's Wife. Time Riders from 1991, about a motorbike riding time traveler, which is a CITV show with Hayden Gwynn. There's Time Slip, which is from the 1970. Lost in Austin from 2008, which is a fantasy adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. There's obviously elements of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. They've got Horrible Histories listed here, which I think maybe someone's missed the point of Horrible Histories there. There's several others. And there's one that I'm going to bring up now because I've not spoken about it for a long time. Primeval,
Oh, yeah,
which
fair enough.
possibly falls into the same category as Randall Hopkirk, deceased, with Vic and Bob, in that maybe there's a lack of confidence in it. I
Yeah.
think when it got going, I think certainly the revival show, because that got cancelled after two or three series, and then it got revived. If I can just get my dates right, it got revived a couple of years later with a slightly different cast, and it was a co-production between ITV and someone else. Can't remember who. They'd replaced, by this point, this is season four, they'd replaced Jason Fleming with Kieran McMenamin, and then kept mostly the rest of the cast, but also introduced Alexander Siddig and Anton Lesser as people with different motivations to the main part of the team. And it felt a lot more confident. But by that point, I think it had maybe, fair to say, ITV had lost confidence in it largely because they were putting it on at stupid times. And I think it had burned through a bit of goodwill as well. And it was going out opposite Matt Smith, or in the same era as Matt Smith. So that's not a recipe for success either. I still like Primeval. I think it was good. It was silly in places, and it didn't make sense in places. And you could see where they'd cut the where the, there was like budget issues, and maybe they thought that there were this. Maybe you sometimes get from actors that this could be better. I'm doing my best here, which is possibly a bit of in Primeval. It's only the first couple of series. I liked it. I've got it on DVD.
Clearly, you do like it then. I never watched it. I never really saw it.
If I was, I
My
mean,
loss, maybe.
I think we've spoken about this before. Maybe it's one that isn't on Spotify at the moment, so I need to get it uploaded. But I'm pretty sure there was a point in the past where we've had a conversation, maybe myself and you and Gareth, or myself and you and Brian, more likely, about what you'd do with Doctor Who if you were in charge of Doctor Who. And what I would do is something like Primeval.
Right, yeah.
Right, Doctor's stuck on Earth, and there's things happening. There's anomalies opening up, time portals, whatever, to the past, and things are coming through. And there's like an overarching plot to save it, to stop it, but also in episode by episode, you have to stop it there and then. And you get all these different possibilities, and I think that just seems like a fun way of doing Doctor Who. Make it fun and monstery, and not too angsty, and more about what's happening and less about the Doctor.
Well, I think Doctor Who sort of gets caught in two threads, and one of them is about Doctor Who is a story which allows time travel to transport a character into multiple different instances, and we'll explore those instances. And then there's Doctor Who as a time travel show about a time traveler who can travel through time, which is the central tenet. And as you say, you get to Jon Pertwee's era, and it's the former rather than the latter. You know, he's been transported to Earth. Now we have this alien on Earth dealing with stuff, and it's not really about time travel. And, you know, shows can do that. I mean, there's multiple shows that do. I mean, Batman does this. You know, Batman is a very rich man who beats down on poor people in his city to maintain the peace and perhaps sort out his own personal anguish over the loss of his parents. You know, it's the libertarian dream, isn't it? You know, anti-government, public structures. We're just, you know, I'm going to take matters into my own hands and sort out people who, you know, remind me of the death of my family, despite the fact I'm very rich and I could afford many therapists. You have that side of him. But you also have the Justice League side of him, which is a dude who is just better than every superhero on the planet, who can go up against gods and various space aliens and pretty much put them in their place. So you have two, they don't really sync.
Is there not three?
What's the third?
The sort of Adam West Batman.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, yeah, that's an iteration maybe of the, well, no, I suppose it isn't, because he is, we're going to digress here. There was a meme I saw the other day, which I thought was quite amusing, and it was basically all the Batmans in a room, who would win? And someone said it'd be Adam West's, because that Adam West would work out all these Batman were Bruce Wayne, and he'd get out a projector and show the death of their parents, and they'd all be so mortally traumatized, he would then just beat them to a pulp. Because he seems, to be fair, he's the most well-adjusted of all of them, who never brings up that, if that even happened in his timeline. I'm not even sure it did. So yeah, Adam West is a fascinating one in terms of, like, yeah, being very different to the rest of the Bat Corps in that sense, but equally as powerful. But yeah, and you get it with Judge Dredd. Judge Dredd will sometimes be a satire on politics and sort of low-key social issues, and there's other times he'd be up against The Walking Dead, Nuclear Armageddon, space aliens, space monsters. Often we have these sort of splits. With Doctor Who, it's interesting because we always see him as a time travel, but so often, a bit like Quantum Leap, the show isn't really about time traveling. It's just the way to deliver you to the spot. And I think that's where mainstream audiences prefer it. I think sci-fi fans, and often the sci-fi fans who are now creators, find, like Moffat, really enjoyed the sheer fun, narrative complexity of non-linear storytelling that you get through time travel. But I don't think that hits home as well. And I think it's interesting now when we could look at America in the last 10 years or so, where time travel has become a very strong device to explore, expand, and reinvigorate franchises and interconnect, which, again, going back to the Flash, is what you have. You know, one of the basic memories of people have of the Flash is one of the end scenes where you see these multiple iterations of the DC universes flapping around in the sky, where you have awful renders of Christopher Reeves and Helen Slater standing there on a building. CG is absolutely terrible. I don't normally say that sort of thing, but it really surprised me. I think someone said it's meant to be, but I don't know why. I don't get it. Adam West Batman is there as well, and even Nicolas Cage's Batman is there.
Superman.
Superman is there. Yeah, and it's just a really weird, but it's about sort of bringing together these titles to consolidate and strengthen a catalogue. And time travel is being used as a sort of diegetic way to sort of bring the audience and go, yeah, they're all interconnected. Now you can enjoy Superman as Christopher Reeves, thinking that he is connected in some way to Adam West's in a sort of tangential way. And we see that with Marvel, and it's an interesting way of sort of pulling these properties together and trying to reinvigorate them. And it's just time travel. The time travel doesn't really make sense, and a lot of it is often alternate universes. But because those alternate universes don't exist at the same time, because they were made in different eras in the 60s and the 90s, time travel is invariably considered part of it. And in The Flash, it is literally part of it. But yeah, I think that is interesting as well, is how they've sort of grappled on this as, oh yeah, we can play with this. It can be fun. We can do wacky things with it. We will justify it more to adult audiences than they did in the past, because in the past they'd just be, oh, you can change the past. But now Marvel has a very strict logic to its time travel, the branches of time. It was the tenet of the Loki series. They brought it up again in previous series and following series in their franchises in their Infinity War stuff as well. And DC have gone, nah, we reject that. This is our version of time travel. And even Doctor Who kind of has its version of time travel, even though it's very flaky. There are nexus points, as we said. The Web of Time is no longer mentioned much, but you do get the impression that it's a flexible thing which can rebuild itself, and it can rebuild itself to be slightly different. And yet at the same time, there'll be certain nodes which have to be there for it to actually work as a web. So yeah, and so in a sense, time travel becomes almost property, almost becomes franchise property, becomes part of their established aesthetic and narrative aesthetic.
I was thinking as well when you were saying before you got to Doctor Who, though, I was thinking that these other franchises, let's use that term, have adopted time travel in order to tie things up, whereas Doctor Who has arguably adopted time travel and in an attempt to tie things up, so more recently, so the Chibnall Timeless Child, and it's kind of not worked out quite as well.
Well, I suppose Doctor Who also has, as part of its ingredient, and it's always kept it there, I think deliberately, that nothing is static, nothing is stable. So it can, and I think even Davis said, I know Paul, in a conversation I had online with Paul Cornell, and he's kind of acknowledged it as well. The Time War, and we've said this before, is kind of a buffer to allow them to reboot without rebooting. So things which are different, they can put down to the Time War. Things that are consistent, they don't have to. And we see that occasionally in Doctor Who, being used as ways to, as you say, create a sort of way of working. But also, if they want to, they can destabilize that. So a next showrunner could quite happily wipe out the Timeless Child, and it either by never acknowledging it or literally doing a kind of like Stephen Moffat did in season five and sort of suggesting that the Big Bang had reset a lot of people's memories on or experiences of previous Russell adventures with Daleks and the likes. So I think Doctor Who's approach is very good, because it's, I think Doctor Who's approach is always, I think its agenda is, oh, I mean, Doctor Who is the bacteria of television. It has absolute, its main goal is to survive and multiply, because that is its formula, that's its DNA. It's built into, it's encoded to survive, to regenerate. Both in the fiction, but also within the production, that people expect it to survive. While other shows, we expect them to die, we expect them to end. But I think Doctor Who's the only one I can think of where we probably see its life as intentionally being one that will never end. That's kind of how it's set up to do. But we know every other story isn't really meant to do that, even though they do. Yeah, Amazing Spider-Man or whatever continues because people recreate the Amazing Spider-Man, but it's not Tobey Maguire's which is continuing. It's not his iteration with a new actor. It's a new version, and that's kind of now been established within their franchises. Doctor Who is the only one which has this bacteria DNA. The closest thing I can think of is soaps, which is just to perpetuate, to exist, to continue and not stop. And time travel is used in Doctor Who rather than soaps to do that. And in fact, soaps often have to negate time travel. I bet they wish they could when they bring characters back. And they're like they were kids at one point and now they're adults and their ages don't sync up. That's quite frequently happens in soaps.
People being murdered and then not being murdered, or died in car crashes and then not died in car crashes.
You know, your narrative, your history only needs to be as stable as your viewer's memory. Unfortunately, these days, that is actually a high, that's hard because there's so much information and so much chronologies to actually fall back on. And that obviously impacts Doctor Who as well. It still frustrates me that by the end of Capaldi's era, he's still calling himself 2,000 years old. And you think, well, okay, even if we accept that he kind of de-ages by Christopher Eccleston is 900. And we have the period where Smith is doing stuff, which is a long period, and you have the period on Trenzalore. You've still got the War Doctor period, which he now acknowledges exists, and the War Doctor was a doctor, which I got the impression was hundreds of years because Hurt literally ages. But you know, if we didn't have all this data and these ways of talking about it, most people would notice that, and the chronology can be vague.
There's a far greater number of US TV
Oh God.
shows with time travel. Just going to pick a few of these out. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventures, was that a cartoon series?
They did do an animated
Did you I
version,
think you
yeah.
mentioned that maybe, yeah.
Yeah, first
Beast
season
Wars.
did have Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves as well doing the
Oh, right,
voices.
okay. Beast Wars Transformers, don't remember that. All right, hang on, going back to the Fonz. Was that actually the Fonz in the
Yeah, it
Fonz?
was Henry Winkler. It was
Was it
Henry
Henry Winkler,
Winkler, and
right?
yeah, and it was
I'm guessing not Ron Howard, though.
yeah, Ron Howard.
Really?
They got Ron Howard. They got Ron Howard. I think they did. They get Potsy or that Ralph. I think was Ralph as well.
Right. Wow.
I don't think Potsy was in it. I think it was Ralph, the Fonz
It's
and
listed here, the Fonz and the
Cunningham.
Happy Days gang. Oh my
Yeah,
word.
it's worth watching some clips on YouTube because it's just wild. Because it's just such a really. I mean, again, what blows my mind is imagining someone sitting in a boardroom or and actually pitching this. Because it just makes no sense as a show.
Well, I mean, it's got to be a result of extracurricular implications, surely, imbibings. I was actually just speaking about Ron Howard. I was watching a comedy movie the other day with Bryce Dallas Howard in and Orlando Bloom called, oh, what's it called? Deep Cover.
Right.
It's on Prime. It's very funny. It's set in London. It's British. It's also got Paddy Considine and Ian McShane in it. It's really good. It's worth as comedies go. I often find with comedy movies, unless they're like Naked Gun or Mel Brooks, I often find that comedies kind of teeter out with a comedy, peter out with a comedy towards the end. Well, this one doesn't. It keeps it going. So it's a good one. I enjoyed that a lot, which is very rare for me to enjoy a comedy movie. So I'd recommend that. But the Heroes had a time travel element as well, did it?
Yes, yeah, end of the first season he
Oh, of
goes
course, yeah,
back.
the of course he did. Goes back to Japan or China. I was never sure where that was, actually. What else is there? We've got the US version of Life on Mars. Terra
Babylon
Nova,
5.
Babylon 5 is not listed.
Surprising that because it has quite a big time travel element, which is part of its key mystery surprise plot reveal. So,
Yeah. 12
one of its main
Monkeys
characters, yeah, 12 Monkeys, yeah,
TV show. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
who cares?
Terminator the Sarah Connor
I was
Chronicles.
thinking about
Yeah. Galactica 1980. Did that have time travel in
that.
it?
Yeah, they went back to World War II. and fought Nazis,
Ah, right, okay. The
of
only
course they did.
thing I remember about that was the episode with Dirk Benedict.
Yeah, the very last one.
Was that the last one? Yeah, that's the only one I remember
Yeah,
about
that's
that.
the last one they had,
Right,
where they
okay.
apparently, because they knew they were being ruined and axed, they went and just did what they wanted for an episode, allegedly. But
Right.
I mean, yeah, there's time travel in all these sort of shows. It's prolific in American stuff, in
Yeah.
American fiction. And as we say, often not that great. I mean, you see it in Star Trek generally, not that great. An interesting show which never did it, which I was always impressed, given it was BBC and the BBC didn't care, was Blake Seven.
Yeah.
Blake Seven was never any sense of time travel whatsoever. I was quite impressed with that. It never went there.
You can kind of see why, because it would have drawn instant comparisons, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's still, I mean, yeah, I'm still, so I Red Dwarf, I think, is probably one of our biggest time travel sci-fi shows, even though it's not a time travel show. But the amount of times it manages timeline, handles timelines, and there's lots of fan theories around. There's some massively fascinating ones around the Inquisitor and Chloe Annette's character, Kachansky.
Yeah, well, that happened in the, was that the second series when they did the first one? Was that Stasis Leak, the first time travel one?
Yeah, well, I mean,
Yeah.
they did in the first. They did one in Future Echoes in the first series, which
Oh,
was
right.
pure hardcore time travel, where you couldn't change anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, that I think Stasis Leak is the one that everyone remembers.
Yeah, I pissed myself laughing at Stasis Leak.
It was one of the first ones I saw, and
Yeah,
it was great fun.
it was, yeah, the, yes. Yeah. Yes. I haven't watched that in years.
I mean, it's a great fan theory. Did you ever see the Inquisitor episode? The one where the guy comes around to raising people from time because they've not lived up to their potential. It's about season five.
Rings a bell.
And there's this fan theory, which is actually really good, which is that the Chloe Annette Kachansky, which we see later on, is the original Kachansky, because she's a
Right.
Kachansky, which is a bit of a loser, is a bit like Lister in a lot of ways. Not that she realizes it, but she doesn't. She never really reaches her potential. And there's this argument that the Inquisitor in season five goes round and erases people who have not met their potential, replacing them with timeline variants of ones who didn't get to exist through conception, and allows them to have a time, have a life. And there's an argument that the second Kachansky is the original Kachansky, who is erased by the Inquisitor, which to bring the Kachansky we see at the beginning of The Dwarf by C.P. Grogan's one, who is more of a high flyer, who is more positive, who isn't hasn't got that slight loser tendency. And that would also explain why Lister does not see a difference between these two Kachanskis, because time has been it's a really clever video I saw, and I was just like, it's one of the few times I thought, this is when I do love fandoms, because sometimes they can do some brilliantly clever, insightful stuff, which is clearly not meant to be there, but makes absolute sense and
Yeah.
enriches what is a silly sitcom. And it's weird, bad chronologies, but yeah, I suppose that's the problem with time travel shows, is that they're the weakest format to inconsistencies and incoherencies, because time travel is very well, because we as we as time travelers we're talking about, it doesn't exist. It's hard to really conceptualize in a way which makes sense, unless you're going through the paradox approaches, the Bill and Ted versions, where you can't change time, you just become part of it and
Yeah.
part of the events which lead up to those decisions, which is the type I like. I mean, what sort of time travel do you like the most?
What a good question. What time travel do I like the most? I like the ones that are fun. I don't really have a preference. I think it's fair to
So it's a
say.
tone.
Yeah, if I mean if it's it I mean there has to be a reason for it. If it's just like, just there to be there, then that makes it less fun. I got to be honest, if the show doesn't already have some sort of element of time travel to it already, I'm very dubious when it's introduced. So, for instance, I mentioned the Once Upon a Time earlier on. That didn't really need to have time travel in it, but they started doing it quite a bit. Charmed, again, did have time travel on it early on, but they then began to heavily rely on it as the series came to its very slow and meandering close with those various series that were renewed just when they thought they were going to get cancelled. They got a new series again and again and again. They had to draw out that storyline. And I think if the, so if it's not baked into it, then I'm not really that interested. If it's something like Star Trek, which is obviously high science, and you, which is not obviously high science, but it positions itself as sort of like sort of futuristic science, and that you're not going to be able to understand it anyway because it's using long words and some at the time theoretical sciences and things, and start throwing around words like tachyons and having an android who can maybe come up with time travel, then maybe then that works. But if it's just like Fonz and the Happy Days Gang, which obviously I haven't seen, but that sort of just throwing time travel in. Do you know what as well though? There's been a few sitcoms with time travel. I think there's another. I mentioned one that's called Time Wasters, but there was another one that was like a fantasy an ITV comedy that was on around the same time as the one with Derek Jacobi and Ian McKellen. Or maybe just after that one, because ITV doesn't do very many comedies at the same time. And this one was like a fantasy thing where a guy got thrown back. It was like a delivery driver or something gets thrown back into the past. Where comedies come into time travel, I don't really think it works very well as a. I don't know. It was because it was trying. It was kind of trying to be Goodnight Sweetheart, but it didn't really have that kind of. Here and there was no real emotional core to it. Whereas Goodnight Sweetheart had like two wives or two or a wife and a girlfriend and then two wives, etc. Which and again going back to that, he was an awful character, really. But the I think we kept watching it because of the situations and this whole idea of him nicking people's songs as well, and because it was so well cast as well and well written, which is obviously an advantage. If something starts to do a time travel, they should leave it there with they did the time travel, don't go back to doing the time travel. Something like Transformers, the Transformers comic tried want desperately wanted to tie into the or certainly the UK comic anyway, desperately wanted to tie into Transformers the movie, which was set in 2006, and we're in
Target
1980.
2006.
Exactly, we were in 1986 at the time, and it wasn't really practical without time travel. So there's Target 2006, and that was good. It was fun. And then about 6 months later, they did more time travel, and then they did more and more and more time travel, and it started getting very, very time travel-y. And if the over reliance on time travel with things that aren't about time travel or don't already rely on time travel because it's not baked into them, like it is with Ashes to Ashes or Red or Life on Mars or Doctor Who. If it's not already about time travel or have time travel in it as a key element of it, then it should just be something that's just done once or twice, not like become the thing that they do as well as the thing that they do. And, the other thing, like, what is my favorite time travel? I think it probably is something like Life on Mars because there is a moment of time travel and then that's it. And then you've got your fish out of water, whatever you want to call it, odd couple
But that's it
relationship.
with Life on Mars, especially. That's very much how it works. It's not really about time travel at all. That's a
Exactly. It
it
just,
plays a sort of a B plot role.
yeah. And I think that's fine like that, because I don't think it needs to be a main plot role, really, because there are enough shows that already do it like that. And if you are going to go there, then you're going to draw obvious comparisons that you probably don't need or don't want as well. So
I think my issues with time travel, the two that I can think of listening to you, is believability. Is that as soon as you move out of an era, out of your contemporary era, you're always going to risk how believable you can make it. And the further back you go, and the more that you need to still tie it in a way which works with your central characters, which, if we go back 500 years, issues of sort of communication of language. They will have to be kind of ignored. Doctor Who obviously does it through temporal circuits and the like, but you start to have risks of pulling people out of the space because you've got to, if it's not believable enough. And that's why I think Life on Mars works really well, is that they do a really good way. It feels, even though we now know that it's a sort of fantasy 70s, it felt like the 70s. It did that well. If you don't do it well, it pulls you out. And I think the other issue I can have, which is more on, say, the sci-fi Star Trek end, is where it becomes a very where you've got shows which are very reliant on syndication and trying to avoid cause and effect. Time travel just has reset buttons, so you can do something. Voyager famously did its couple of episodes of the year of hell or whatever they called it. And then at the very end of this long story of them having a really hard year, there's a reset button and it's all doesn't happen. And I think that's inherently dissatisfying for audiences. So I think those are always my two no's in time travel, is where they become easy get outs, or the resolution feels too easy or too unsatisfying for what you've built up towards. I think those are the things that I dislike the most. So can you make the place feel believable? Which becomes harder the further back you go in time, but also, yeah, does it actually make the story dissatisfying by how you utilize it? Which is why I think, as I say, I always quite like the Bill and Ted way, because it stops you from doing that. You can't just change time and suddenly everything's better again. You are your results,
You're part
your
of it.
choices. Yes, you have an impact. There's a definitive impact there.
Yeah, I think I probably like that the best. Do you know you've one show that we didn't mention, Star Trek Enterprise,
Oh yes, yeah.
which I think
It's temporal war.
which is guilty on all counts of all of the things we've just described, I
Yeah,
feel.
no, absolutely. And obviously Doctor Who is as well occasionally.
Yeah.
There's no doubt that as show it is it falls flat on both those fronts. But I think yeah, this is I think time it's a funny thing, you know, we start this off talking about time travel shows, and I think if there's anything of anyone who's stupid enough to be listening to this gets out of this. It's just that things is that is a genre category which itself is just doesn't do justice for the such different ways that time travel is utilized within shows, be it within the story, be it within its production, be it within how it works within the story as a central episode, as a central tenant, as a secondary point. Because, like you say, even like Goodnight Sweetheart, yeah, it's about time travel, and you're kind of watching because you're interested in those two different aesthetics. But ultimately, you're watching a guy live two lives. In the same way, funnily enough, you think of a Low, a Low, kind of the same sort of slight dirtbag as a lead character who we watch and kind of accept, even though we shouldn't. You know, his wife is actually a nice person. She's not a horrid person, and yet he's trying to cheat on her all the way through the show. And we find that hilarious. But yeah, the time travel in Goodnight Sweetheart becomes almost secondary in the same way as it does in Life on Mars and even Quantum Leap. And yet we never talked about Back to the Future.
Well,
Sorry, everyone.
we nearly did when you was talking about spaghetti earlier on. I was imagining Michael Keaton as Doc Brown. Is it intentionally done like that scene, or no?
I
Okay.
know it could be, yeah, it was a bit like that.
Okay. Yeah. And
Yeah.
also I'm thinking also of a story called Behold the Man, in which a time traveler travels back to the time of Jesus to find Jesus, only he's not there, and he realizes that his miraculous arrival gives him the responsibility of enacting various things from the Bible that he can recall. And that goes into what we've just discussed. That's that time travel that doesn't actually change anything. It just fulfills a historical role without changing anything.
And yet you get Back to the Future, which does both. It,
Yes.
you know, he goes back and he kind of in an awkward white way invents music, which he shouldn't really be inventing, and is the one who encourages a mayor of color to become mayor, almost, or taking away their agency and things like that. I think what's the funniest thing with Back to the Future for me, and the way I see it, and we might have talked about this many years ago on the podcast, is that whole thing about, you know, Marty coming back to 1985, 1980, 1984, 1984 is, no, it's 1985, isn't it?
985, yeah.
1985, 30 years, 1985, and finding that his whole world has changed, and he doesn't quite, he's the only one who doesn't really work in it. Everyone else, you know, because he's changed time. And I've always loved this idea that when he comes back in time, comes back from the future, back from the past into the future, and then sees himself leaping into the DeLorean, heading back into the past, that Marty will have been the Marty from this middle class family that he now meets at the end of the film, who goes back in time, must fuck everything
Yes.
up and create the timeline of Marty as living in a sort of poor house with the poor families we see at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
So the two of them are constantly recreating each other's timelines. That's how
Yes.
I like to see it.
Wow. Yeah,
So,
I'd never thought of it like that, but yeah, of course.
but I mean, that was never intended. But again,
No.
that's the fun, few th fun
Yeah.
things about time is that you can start reintegrating it as audiences.
I was watching a video interview with it just came up my feed on YouTube the other day with Eric Stoltz, which set me on a bit of a rabbit hole into which parts of Marty McFly are still Eric Stoltz. There's an interview with Thomas Wilson who swears he was only punched once, and that was by Eric Stoltz in the canteen, in the diner. So the fist is probably Eric Stoltz, and also Marty diving into the DeLorean in the scene you've just said. The close-up shot or the long shot of it might be both. It might be one or the other. I might be wrong on which one it is. But also, one of those is Eric Stoltz as well, apparently.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. I was listening to an interview recently. I'm trying to think who it was with who was talking about Eric Stoltz and Back to the Future. I can't think who it was with now. And then also that comes up in The Flash as well, because in that timeline, Eric Stoltz is Marty McFly, and that's the shock, you know, it's talking about. And
Oh,
they're like,
right.
what? He's like, you know, the main Flash is like, what's going on here? Michael J. Fox is Marty McFly. And they go, no, it's Eric Stoltz. You know, what are you talking about? But yeah, I mean that's an interesting one where there is that sort of weird production thing,
Because apparently they'd
which
shot
is.
nearly the whole movie. That's the thing. I didn't realize how much of it they'd actually filmed. And obviously, I knew about Eric Stoltz years ago, but finding out how much of the movie was actually filmed and what reshoots were done, and I really didn't really get an idea of it until the Thomas F. Wilson interview, when he said he wasn't called back to reshoot that particular scene, but most of them they reshot, and that's like wow. They've nearly made an entire movie and then they've recast the lead.
Yeah, I'm still trying to remember who it is now, who I was listening to an interview who was sort of saying and how it was shocking for them, given they knew Eric, or someone who knew Eric, and you know, from their perspective. But yeah, they could see the differences. Yeah, I mean that's a fascinating movie in itself, you know, that
Yeah.
is worth a podcast, is Back to the Future. And everything surrounding it, including the video game spin-off, which was very good. And the
Which
comic
one?
spin-offs.
Hold on. Which video game spin-off? The Back to the Future
There
2
was
game.
no the Back to the Future, kind of like the sort of like Telltale sort of approach,
Oh, right. I
that was
haven't seen
done
that.
about, don't
Well,
know, it must have been
recently
like
then.
2010,
Right. Okay.
2011, and it
Okay.
kind of follows on.
Okay. I
It's on
haven't seen
Steam.
that. Right. I'll have a look for that. No, I thought you meant the Back to the
It's very
Future 2
good.
game that came with my Amiga 500, which was absolutely
Yes, I
terrible.
but I loved it.
It was
It was terrible, but I
unplayable.
loved it. I played it. I played the Spectrum version as well. The first game was bad. That was a really odd one on the Spectrum.
Oh, I don't
You
remember
ever
that
see
one.
that?
No, I don't.
No. You
No.
kind of walked up and down the high street and you had to sort of kind of tap people or give them things to try and stop the picture from disappearing. It was very basic.
All
You
right.
had a skateboard and you had to get away from Gib Biff, but compared to that, the second game was great. But yeah, no, you find the Back to the Future because it is a continuation, so it continues the story onwards. It's quite a lot of fun.
I
Michael J. Fox does appear in it.
I did this last night. You can just see that there. I'm taking apart a BBC
Okay.
Micro
Oh, yeah.
and I put in a ROM chip and added an SD card reader at the back. You need the ROM chip to use the SD card reader as a disk. And then, and you, anyone interested in this, I'll put it in the show notes. You can have a look at my Gaming Retro Patreon for this. I installed that and then I booted the computer up and I get this sort of teletext-like menu of all the games that are on this SD card. They've all been made available for use on this system because it's a dead system, so there's no piracy. The sheer, just the index of it, and in that list of games was a bunch of things that I didn't even know were on the BBC, but I knew from the Spectrum, the C64, and this list is like so long. I know we're getting away from the point there, but the whole teletext thing really, really made me feel nostalgic for actual teletext, because it was because the teletext itself was based on a BBC micro in in an office at the BBC with a special transmitter going out the back. They had BBC micros that were powering teletext.
But very quickly, and I think we're probably coming to the end of this, but
Yeah.
in terms of like time travel, I mean, going back to what you said with Life on Mars, you talk about BBC Micro, you know, time travel for the audience is in some degree period drama within their lifetime. So I was
Yes.
watching the Gold series that what the BBC did about the Brinkmap robberies in the 80s, which was the first season's very good. Second season, I kind of lost interest in. But again, you're watching it a bit like people watch Stranger Things or Life on Mars or Ashes to Ashes, to sort of to get a sense to almost time travel, to reconfigure your brain to remember what it's like
Yeah.
in those periods. And one of the things which struck me with Gold is that where it doesn't really work is I realize that my memory of those periods is largely based on the television of those periods. So when Gold uses more contemporary production techniques in terms of like how the camera moves, drone shots and the like, it to me suddenly doesn't feel like the 80s. Not because
Yeah.
what they're showing is wrong, but it's just I'm used to seeing the 80s through a different lens, which is 80s television.
Yeah.
And that lens is far more static. It's a different approach to
Yeah.
production, and that not seeing that, and that's kind of a weird, sad thing because it makes you think, well, yeah, the 80s I kind of linked to really is what was filmed on television, because I don't have much footage other than static footage to show me otherwise. And I can't time travel back as well with Gold as I could with Minder. Because, but then Minder is, I am time traveling back to a production aesthetic as much as I am. But then that production aesthetic is rooted in that period. And am I being reminded of living in the 80s, or am I being reminded of watching television in the 80s? Because they're two different things.
Yes, or are you being reminded of your impending death?
No,
Okay, good.
because we don't think about
I was bringing up excuse me,
that.
I
Almost
wasn't
sounded
bringing
like
this
a
up.
threat, Christian.
It did, didn't it? I'm so sorry. A long and prosperous life to you, James. I had a just because we're on talking about mind, and just to maybe to round things off a bit, a thing came up on Facebook, which I don't use very often. I basically went on there to see what my dad was messaging me from one of the groups I'm not a member of, which he does a lot. My dad's in like Navy groups and things. I'm not in that group, Dad, for obvious reasons. Anyway, and up came a picture of George Cole and Dennis Waterman outside a location in London where there was a bent lamppost when they filmed it. The bent lamppost's not there now. You're not going to be able to see the bent lamppost anymore. The lamppost's gone completely, and all that's there is a bollard. And it just made me think they were having a bit of fun taking photos around this bent lamppost, presumably waiting for the scene to start shooting. And when we think about time travel, we often think about just going to just reliving a place or whatever. But there's like little elements like that. Those little moments that you don't see on the TV version of what you've just watched and what you're appreciating, the stuff that's going on behind the camera. So we look at old TV shows and it reminds us of our time of watching that TV show and the story of the TV show and everything. But of course, in the fiction, beyond the fiction of the TV show, there's some actors and producers and key grips and sound men and stuff running around and stuff. And that's happening as well. And the time travel element kind of doesn't really refer to those people particularly, and we kind of overlook that. But that's also happening there as well.
Yeah, it's an almost like an inaccurate window into a period, which itself is it's being controlled. I suppose the best thing to watch is like I don't know. I mean, I was watching Gold and I was thinking, you know, these conventional ways of filming, we're taking out, as we say, that sort of minder element of watching the 80s. And I was thinking, is this kind of good? Because when I was in the 80s, it never felt as artificially different as it does on television. And actually, when you take away the production manners and the sort of graininess or the way it's cut, and you look at the world doesn't change that much. I mean, at the moment, as you may have noticed, mullets are back, and we don't really pay much attention to them. I'm just thinking, if you walk down the street in the 80s to now, I wonder how different it would really feel. I mean, obviously, it feels really different when you watch in, say, Life on Mars, when they do that early street scene, when they do that turn, they do that 360 around the street. But would it feel that much different? Is it just we think it would? But ultimately, when we were there, it didn't feel crazy or weird or empty or lacking of technology.
No.
Would it feel that different? I don't know. And I suppose the whole point of time travel is to try and show you that things are different. Because if things look the same, you lose the time travel. But ultimately, I wonder how different it really would be. It's a weird one that I suppose that's why time traveling is such an engaging narrative concept, because we're just so desperate to kind of understand that, to what was it like? What was it like? And especially as an adult, how would I see it now as an adult?
Yeah, and of course, what's going to happen next?
Yeah, I mean that's always part of the time travel narrative is that knowledge of the future, isn't it? Is that's part of, and part of often the jokes. What a female prime minister, that would be crazy, that sort of thing. Yeah, it was crazy. But yeah, I don't know. I just it's an interesting concept, which I suppose TV and film are still actually not too great at managing to realize in a way which I think is satisfying. And when it is, there is a question of is it satisfying because it feels exotically alien and then interesting, like Life on Mars, or but is that really what it would be like? I don't know. It's hard to say.
It is hard to say. We'll leave it there. In terms of that conversation, so let us know what time travel things that you like, whether Doctor Who or whether particular elements of Doctor Who or whether Life on Mars or any of the other things, Star Trek, Red Dwarf, any of the other things that they've mentioned or something that we've missed as well. Particularly if we've missed something completely obvious that we should have included that doesn't include our normal passage through time on a day-by-day basis, because that's too obvious.
And don't say early edition, because yeah, I had thought of that, but it didn't last very long.
I don't know what that is. I'll look that
No,
up
early
later.
edition. Have a look
No,
at it. Look it
I'll have a
up.
look at
Look
it.
it up.
I'll look it up. So thank you for watching. And if you're on Patreon, thank you for listening everywhere else. Please don't forget that I issue tri-weekly updates for Casterbus and now available at casterbus.substack.com. And so far, there's been articles on Doctor Who and Monty Python and a book by the scientist Fred Hoyle, which may sound very dry and boring until you realize it's a Ladybird book and it's very similar to Doctor Who. And there's a lot more to come along there as well. Old articles from Casterbrus and new articles from me in a more contemporaneous sense as well. So check that out. And if you're not already a member of our Patreon, please join. You'll get this episode in its video entirety and with a little bit of extra content. If you're on Patreon, if you're not on Patreon, then this episode is a bit shorter, basically. So we'll be back again soon. Until next time, it's goodbye from us.